It was a low room, almost completely filled by a bedstead. Ralph stood by the window in his undershirt. His boots and outer clothing were piled on the floor. His face was flushed with drink, but his speech was clear and steady. "Take off your dress," he said with a smile of anticipation. Gwenda said, "No." He looked startled. "I'm not taking my clothes off," she said. "Why did you tell Alan you wanted to see me in private?" "So that you would think I was willing to have sex with you."
"But if not, why are you here?"
"To beg you to ask the king for a pardon."
"But you're not offering yourself to me."
"Why would I? I did that once before, and you broke your word. You reneged on the deal. I gave you my body, but you didn't give my husband his land." She allowed the contempt she felt to be heard in her tone of voice. "You would do the same again. Your honor is nothing. You remind me of my father."
Ralph colored. It was an insult to tell an earl that he could not be trusted, and even more offensive to compare him with a landless laborer who trapped squirrels in the woods. Angrily he said, "Do you imagine this is the way to persuade me?"
"No, but you're going to get that pardon."
"Why?"
"Because Sam is your son."
Ralph stared at her for a moment. "Ha!" he said contemptuously. "As if I would believe that."
"He is your son," she repeated.
"You can't prove that."
"No, I can't," she said. "But you know that I lay with you at the Bell in Kingsbridge 9 months before Sam was born. True, I lay with Wulfric too. So which of you is his father?"
"Look at the boy.
He has some of Wulfric's mannerisms, yes. He has learned those in 22 years. But look at his features."
She saw a thoughtful expression appear on Ralph's face, and knew that something she had said had hit the mark.
"Most of all, think about his character," she said, pressing home. "You heard the evidence at the trial. Sam didn't just fight Jono off, as Wulfric would have done. He didn't knock him down, then help him up again, which would have been Wulfric's way. Wulfric is strong and quick to anger, but he's tender-hearted. Sam is not. Sam hit Jono with a spade, a blow that would have knocked any man senseless. Then, before Jono fell, Sam hit him again, even harder, although he was already helpless. And then, before Jono's limp form reached the ground, Sam hit him a third time. If the old church peasants hadn't jumped on Sam and restrained him, he would have continued to lash out with that bloody spade until Jono's head was smashed to a pulp. He wanted to kill." She realized she was crying and wiped the tears away with her sleeve. Ralph was staring at her with a horrified look. "Where does the killer instinct come from, Ralph?" she said. "Look in your own black heart. Sam is your son. And, God forgive me, he's mine." When Gwenda had gone, Ralph sat on the bed in the little chamber, staring at the flame of the candle. Was it possible? Gwenda would lie, if it suited her, of course. There was no question of trusting her. But Sam could be Ralph's son, as easily as Wulfric's. They had both lain with Gwenda at the crucial time. The truth might never be known for sure. Even the possibility that Sam might be his child was enough to fill Ralph's heart with dread. Was he about to hang his own son? The dreadful punishment he had devised for Wulfric might be inflicted on himself. It was already night. The hanging would take place at dawn. Ralph did not have long to decide. He picked up the candle and left the little room. He had intended to satisfy a carnal desire there. Instead, he had been given the shock of his life. He went outside and crossed the courtyard to the cell block. On the ground floor of the building were offices for the sheriff's deputies. He went inside and spoke to the man on guard duty. "I want to see the murderer, Sam Wigley."
"Very good, my lord," the jailer said. "I'll show you the way."
He led Ralph into the next room, carrying a lamp.
There was a grating set in the floor, and a bad smell. Ralph looked down through the grating. The cell was 9 or 10 feet deep, with stone walls and a dirt floor. There was no furniture. Sam sat on the floor with his back against the wall. Beside him was a wooden jug, presumably containing water. A small hole in the floor appeared to be the toilet. Sam glanced up, then looked away indifferently.
"Open up," said Ralph.
The jailer unlocked the grating with a key. It swung up on a hinge.
"I want to go down."
The jailer was surprised, but did not dare argue with an earl. He picked up a ladder that was leaning against the wall and slid it into the cell.
"Take care, please, my lord," he said nervously.
"Remember, the villain has nothing to lose." Ralph climbed down, carrying his candle. The smell was disgusting, but he hardly cared. He reached the foot of the ladder and turned. Sam looked up at him resentfully and said,
"What do you want?"
Ralph stared at him. He crouched down and held the candle close to Sam's face, studying his features, trying to compare them with the face he saw when he looked into a mirror.
"What is it?" Sam said, spooked by Ralph's intense stare.
Ralph did not answer.
Was this his own child? It could be, he thought. It could easily be.
Sam was a good-looking boy, and Ralph had been called handsome in his youth, before his nose got broken. In court earlier, Ralph had thought that something about Sam's face rang a bell, and now he concentrated, searching his memory, trying to think who Sam reminded him of. That straight nose, the dark-eyed gaze, the head of thick hair that girls would envy. Then he got it. Sam looked like Ralph's mother, the late Lady Maud.
"Dear God," he said,
and it came out as a whisper.
"What?"
said Sam, his voice betraying fear.
"What is this?"
Ralph had to say something.
"Your mother,"
he began. Then he trailed off. His throat was constricted with emotion, making it difficult for him to get words out. He tried again.
"Your mother has pleaded for you, most eloquently."
Sam looked wary and said nothing. He thought Ralph had come here to mock him.
"Tell me," Ralph said, "when you hit Jono with that spade, did you mean to kill him? You can be honest. You have nothing more to fear."
"Of course I meant to kill him," Sam said. "He was trying to take me in."
Ralph nodded. "I would have felt the same," he said. He paused, staring at Sam, then said it again.
"I would have felt the same."
He stood up, turned to the ladder, hesitated, then turned back and put the candle on the ground next to Sam. Then he climbed up. The jailer replaced the grating and locked it. Ralph said to him, "There will be no hanging. The prisoner will be pardoned. I will speak to the sheriff immediately." As he left the room, the jailer sneezed. Chapter 85. When Merthyn and Carris returned from Shiring to Kingsbridge, they found that Lola had gone missing. Their long-standing house servants, Arne and Em, were waiting at the garden gate, and looked as if they had been stationed there all day. Em began to speak, but burst into incoherent sobs, and Arne had to break the news.
"We can't find Lola," he said, distraught. "We don't know where she is."
At first, Merthyn misunderstood.
"She'll be here by supper time," he said. "Don't upset yourself, Em." "But she didn't come home last night, nor the night before," Arne said.
Merthyn realized then what they meant. She had run away. A blast of fear, like a winter wind, chilled his skin and gripped his heart. She was only 16. For a moment he could not think rationally. He just pictured her, halfway between child and adult, with the intense dark brown eyes and sensual mouth of her mother, and an expression of blithe, false confidence. When rationality returned to him, he asked himself what had gone wrong. He had been leaving Lola in the care of Arne and Em for a few days at a time, ever since she was 5 years old, and she had never come to any harm. Had something changed? He realized that he had hardly spoken to her since Easter Sunday, 2 weeks ago, when he had taken her by the arm and pulled her away from her disreputable friends outside the White Horse. She had sulked upstairs while the family ate dinner, and had not emerged even when Sam was arrested. She had still been in a snit a few days later, when Merthyn and Caris had kissed her goodbye and set out for Shiring. Guilt stabbed him. He had treated her harshly and driven her away. Was Sylvia's ghost watching and despising him for his failure to care for their daughter? The thought of Lola's disreputable friends came back to him. "That fellow Jake Riley is behind this," he said. "Have you spoken to him, Arne?"
"No, master."
"I'd better do that right away. Do you know where he lives?"
"He lodges next to the fishmongers behind St. Paul's Church."
Caris said to Merthyn, "I'll go with you." They crossed the bridge back into the city and headed west. The parish of St. Paul took in the industrial premises along the waterfront, abattoirs, leather tanners, sawmills, manufactories, and the dyers that had sprung up like September mushrooms since the invention of Kingsbridge Scarlet. Merthyn headed for the squat tower of St. Paul's Church, visible over the low roofs of the houses. He found the fish shop by smell, and knocked at a large run-down house next door. It was opened by Sal Sawyers, poor widow of a jobbing carpenter who had died in the plague.
"Jake comes and goes, Alderman," she said. "I haven't seen him for a week. He can do as he pleases, so long as he pays the rent."
Carrie said, "When he left, was Lola with him?" Sal warily looked sideways at Merthyn.
"I don't like to criticize," she said.
Merthyn said, "Please just tell me what you know. I won't be offended."
"She's usually with him. She does anything Jake wants. I'll say no more than that. If you look for him, you'll find her."
"Do you know where he might have gone?"
"He never says."
"Can you think of anyone who might know?"
"He doesn't bring his friends here, except for her. But I believe his pals are usually to be found at the White Horse."
Merthyn nodded. "We'll try there. Thank you, Sal."
"She'll be all right," Sal said. "She's just going through a wild phase."
"I hope you're right." Merthyn and Caris retraced their steps until they came to the White Horse, on the riverside near the bridge. Merthyn recalled the orgy he had witnessed here at the height of the plague, when the dying Davy Whitehorse had given away all his ale. The place had stood empty for several years afterwards, but now it was once again a busy tavern. Merthyn often wondered why it was popular. The rooms were cramped and dirty, and there were frequent fights. About once a year, someone was killed there. They went into a smoky parlour. It was mid-afternoon, but there were a dozen or so desultory drinkers sitting on benches. A small group was clustered around a backgammon board, and several small piles of silver pennies on the table indicated that money was being wagered on the outcome. A red-cheeked prostitute called Joy looked up hopefully at the newcomers, then saw who they were and relapsed into bored indolence. In a corner, a man was showing a woman an expensive-looking coat, apparently offering it for sale. But when he saw Merthyn, he folded the garment quickly and put it out of sight, and Merthyn guessed it was stolen property. The landlord, Evan, was eating a late dinner of fried bacon. He stood up, wiping his hands on his tunic, and said nervously, "Good day to you, Alderman. An honour to have you in the house. May I draw you a pot of ale?"
"I'm looking for my daughter, Lola," Merthyn said briskly.
"Haven't seen her for a week," said Evan.
Sal had said exactly the same about Jake, Merthyn recalled. He said to Evan, "She may be with Jake Riley."
"Yes, I've noticed that they're friendly," Evan said tactfully. "He's been gone about the same length of time."
"Do you know where he went?"
"He's a close-lipped type, is Jake," said Evan. "If you asked him how far it was to Shiring, he'd shake his head and frown and say it was none of his business to know such things."
The whore, Joy, had been listening to the conversation, and now she chipped in.
"He's open-handed, though,"
she said. "Fair's fair."
Merthyn gave her a hard look. "And where does his money come from?"
"Horses," she said. "He goes around the villages buying foals from peasants and sells them in the towns."
"He probably stole horses from unwary travellers, too," Merthyn thought sourly. "Is that what he's doing now? Buying horses?" Evan said, "Very likely. The big fair season is coming up. He could be acquiring his stock in trade." "And perhaps Lola went with him."
"Not wishing to give offence, Alderman, but it's quite likely."
"It's not you who has given offence," Merthyn said. He nodded a curt farewell and left the tavern, with Carris following.
"That's what she's done," he said angrily. "She's gone off with Jake. She probably thinks it's a great adventure."
"I'm afraid I think you're right," Carris said. "I hope she doesn't become pregnant."
"I wish that was the worst I feared."
They headed automatically for home. Crossing the bridge, Merthyn stopped at the highest point and looked out over the suburban rooftops to the forest beyond. His little girl was somewhere out there with a shady horse dealer. She was in danger, and there was nothing he could do to protect her.
When Merthyn went to the cathedral the next morning to check on the new tower, he found that all work had stopped.
"Prior's orders," said Brother Thomas, when Merthyn questioned him. Thomas was almost 60 years old and showing his age. His soldierly physique was bent, and he shuffled around the precincts unsteadily.
"There's been a collapse in the South Aisle," he said.
Merthyn glanced at Bartlemy French, a gnarled old mason from Normandy, who was sitting outside the lodge, sharpening a chisel. Bartlemy shook his head in silent negation.
"That collapse was 24 years ago, Brother Thomas," Merthyn said.
"Ah, yes, you're right," said Thomas. "My memory's not as good as it used to be, you know."
Merthyn patted his shoulder. "We're all getting older."
Bartlemy said, "The prior is up the tower, if you want to see him."
Merthyn certainly did. He went into the north transept, stepped through a small archway, and climbed a narrow spiral stair within the wall. As he passed from the old crossing into the new tower, the color of the stones changed from the dark gray of storm clouds to the light pearl of the morning sky. It was a long climb. The tower was already more than 300 feet high. However, he was used to it. Almost every day for 11 years he had climbed a stair that was higher each time. It occurred to him that Philemon, who was quite fat nowadays, must have had a compelling reason to drag his bulk up all these steps. Near the top, Merthyn passed through a chamber that housed the great wheel, a wooden winding mechanism, twice as high as a man, used for hoisting stones, mortar, and timber up to where they were needed. When the spire was finished, the wheel would be left here permanently, to be used for repair work by future generations of builders, until the trumpet sounded on the day of judgment. He emerged on top of the tower. A stiff, cold breeze was blowing, though none had been noticeable at ground level. A leaded walkway ran around the inside of the tower's summit. Scaffolding stood around an octagonal hole, ready for the masons who would build the spire. Dressed stones were piled nearby, and a heap of mortar was drying up wastefully on a wooden board. There were no workmen here. Prior Philemon stood on the far side with Harold Mason. They were deep in conversation, but stopped guiltily when Merthyn came into view. He had to shout into the wind to make himself heard.
"Why have you stopped the building?"
Philemon had his answer ready.
"There's a problem with your design."
Merthyn looked at Harold.
"You mean some people can't understand it?" "Experienced people say it can't be built," Philemon said defiantly.
"Experienced people," Merthyn repeated scornfully.
"Who in Kingsbridge is experienced? Who has built a bridge? Who has worked with the great architects of Florence? Who has seen Rome, Avignon, Paris, Rouen? Certainly not Harold here. No offence, Harold. But you've never even been to London."
Harold said, "I'm not the only one who thinks it's impossible to build an octagonal tower with no formwork."
Merthin was about to say something sarcastic, but stopped himself. Philemon must have more than this, he realized. The prior had deliberately chosen to fight this battle. Therefore, he must have weapons more formidable than the mere opinion of Harold Mason. He had presumably won some support among members of the guild. But how? Other builders, who were prepared to say that Merthin's spire was impossible, must have been offered some incentive. That probably meant construction work for them. What is it? He said to Philemon. What are you hoping to build?
I don't know what you mean, Philemon blustered.
You've got an alternative project, and you've offered Harold and his friends a piece of it. What's the building?
You don't know what you're talking about.
A bigger palace for yourself? A new chapter house? It can't be a hospital. We've already got three. Come on, you might as well tell me. Unless you're ashamed of it.
Philemon was stung into a response.
The monks wish to build a lady chapel.
Ah, that made sense. The cult of the Virgin was increasingly popular. The church hierarchy approved, because the wave of piety associated with Mary counterbalanced the skepticism and heresy that had afflicted congregations since the plague. Numerous cathedrals and churches were adding a special small chapel at the east end, holiest part of the building, dedicated to the Mother of God. Merthin did not like the architecture. On most churches, a lady chapel looked like an afterthought, which of course it was. What was Philemon's motive? He was always trying to ingratiate himself with someone. That was his modus operandi. A lady chapel at Kingsbridge would undoubtedly please conservative senior clergy. This was the second move Philemon had made in that direction. On Easter Sunday, from the pulpit of the cathedral, he had condemned dissection of corpses. He was mounting a campaign, Merthin realized. But what was its purpose? Merthin decided to do nothing more until he had figured out what Philemon was up to. Without saying anything further, he left the roof and started down the series of staircases and ladders to the ground. Merthin arrived home at the dinner hour, and Caris came in from the hospital a few minutes later. Brother Thomas is getting worse, he said to Caris. Is there anything that can be done for him? She shook her head. There's no cure for senility. He told me the south aisle had collapsed, as if it had happened yesterday. That's typical. He remembers the distant past, but doesn't know what's going on today. Poor Thomas. He'll probably deteriorate quite fast, but at least he's in a familiar place. Monasteries don't change much over the decades. His daily routine is probably the same as it has always been. That will help. As they sat down to mutton stew with leeks and mint, Merthin explained the morning's developments. The two of them had been battling Kingsbridge priors for decades, first Antony, then Godwin, and now Philemon. They had thought that the granting of the borough charter would put an end to the constant jockeying. It had certainly improved matters, but it seemed Philemon had not given up yet. I'm not really worried about the spire, Merthin said. Bishop Henri will overrule Philemon and order the building restarted just as soon as he hears. Henri wants to be bishop of the tallest cathedral in England. Philemon must know that, Caris said thoughtfully. Perhaps he simply wants to make the gesture towards a lady chapel and get the credit for trying, while blaming his failure on someone else. Perhaps, Caris said doubtfully. In Merthin's mind there was a more important question. But what is he really after? Everything Philemon does is driven by the need to make himself feel important, Caris said confidently. My guess is he's after a promotion. What job could he have in mind? The Archbishop of Monmouth seems to be dying, but surely Philemon can't hope for that position. He must know something we don't. Before they could say any more, Lola walked in. Merthin's first reaction was a feeling of relief so powerful that it brought tears to his eyes. She was back, and she was safe. He looked her up and down. She had no apparent injuries. She walked with a spring in her step, and her face showed only the usual expression of moody discontent. Caris spoke first.
"You're back," she said. "I'm so glad." "Are you?"
Lola said. She often pretended to believe that Caris did not like her. Merthin was not fooled, but Caris could be thrown into doubt, for she was sensitive about not being Lola's mother.
"We're both glad," Merthin said. "You gave us a scare."
"Why?"
said Lola. She hung her cloak on a hook and sat at the table.
"I was perfectly all right."
"But we didn't know that, so we were terribly worried."
"You shouldn't be," Lola said. "I can take care of myself."
Merthin suppressed an angry retort.
"I'm not sure you can," he said as mildly as possible.
Caris stepped in to try to lower the temperature.
"Where did you go?" she asked.
"You've been away for 2 weeks. Different places."
Merthin said tightly, "Can you give us one or two examples?"
"Mudderford Crossing, Casterham, Athenby."
"And what have you been doing?"
"Is this the catechism?" she said petulantly. "Do I have to answer all these questions?"
Caris put a restraining hand on Merthin's arm and said to Lola, "We just want to know that you haven't been in danger." Merthin said, "I'd also like to know who you've been traveling with."
"Nobody special."
"Does that mean Jake Riley?" She shrugged and looked embarrassed.
"Yes,"
she said, as if it were a trivial detail. Merthin had been ready to forgive and embrace her, but she was making that difficult. Trying to keep his voice neutral, he said, "What sleeping arrangements did you and Jake have?"
"That's my business," she cried.
"No, it's not," he shouted back. "It's mine, too, and your stepmother's. If you're pregnant, who will care for your baby? Are you confident that Jake is ready to settle down and be a husband and father? Have you talked to him about that?" "Don't speak to me," she yelled.
Then she burst into tears and stomped up the stairs. Merthin said, "Sometimes I wish we lived in one room. Then she wouldn't be able to pull that trick."
"You weren't very gentle with her," Caris said with mild disapproval.
"What am I supposed to do?" Merthin said. "She talks as if she's done nothing wrong."
"She knows the truth, though. That's why she's crying."
"Oh, hell!"
he said. There was a knock, and a novice monk put his head around the door.
"Pardon me for disturbing you, Alderman," he said. "Sir Gregory Longfellow is at the Priory, and would be grateful for a word with you, as soon as is convenient."
"Damn,"
said Merthin. "Tell him I'll be there in a few minutes."
"Thank you,"
the novice said, and left.
Merthin said to Caris, "Perhaps it's just as well to give her time to cool off."
"You, too," Caris said.
"You're not taking her side, are you?"
he said with a touch of irritation. She smiled and touched his arm.
"I'm on your side always," she said. "But I remember what it was like to be a 16-year-old girl. She's as worried as you are about her relationship with Jake. But she's not admitting it even to herself, because that would wound her pride. So she resents you for speaking the truth. She has constructed a fragile defense around her self-esteem, and you just tear it down."
"What should I do?"
"Help her build a better fence."
"I don't know what that means."
"You'll figure it out. I'd better go and see Sir Gregory."
Merthin stood up. Caris put her arms around him and kissed him on the lips.
"You're a good man doing your best, and I love you with all my heart," she said.
That took the edge off his frustration, and he felt himself calm down as he strode across the bridge and up the main street to the Priory. He did not like Gregory. The man was sly and unprincipled, willing to do anything for his master, the king, just as Philemon had been when he served Godwin as prior. Merthin wondered uneasily what Gregory wanted to discuss with him. It was probably taxes, always the king's worry. Merthin went first to the prior's palace, where Philemon, looking pleased with himself, told him that Sir Gregory was to be found in the monks' cloisters to the south of the cathedral. Merthin wondered what Gregory had done to win himself the privilege of holding audience there. The lawyer was getting old. His hair was white, and his tall figure was stooped. Deep lines had appeared like brackets either side of that sneering nose, and one of the blue eyes was cloudy. But the other eye saw sharply enough, and he recognized Merthyn instantly, though they had not met for 10 years.
"Alderman," he said, "the Archbishop of Monmouth is dead."
"Rest his soul," Merthyn said automatically. "Amen. The king asked me as I was passing through his borough of Kingsbridge to give you his greetings and tell you this important news."
"I'm grateful. The death is not unexpected. The Archbishop has been ill."
The king certainly had not asked Gregory to meet with Merthyn purely to give him interesting information, he thought suspiciously.
"You're an interesting man, if you don't mind my saying so," Gregory said expansively. "I first met your wife more than 20 years ago. Since then I've seen the two of you slowly but surely take control of this town. And you've got everything you set your hearts on, the bridge, the hospital, the borough charter, and each other. You're determined, and you're patient."
It was condescending, but Merthyn was surprised to detect a grain of respect in Gregory's flattery. He told himself to remain mistrustful. Men such as Gregory praised only for a purpose. "I'm on my way to see the monks of Abergavenny, who must vote for a new archbishop." Gregory leaned back in his chair. "When Christianity first came to England hundreds of years ago, monks elected their own superiors." Explaining was an old man's habit, Merthyn reflected. The young Gregory would not have bothered. Nowadays, of course, bishops and archbishops are too important and powerful to be chosen by small groups of pious idealists living detached from the world. The king makes his choice, and His Holiness the Pope ratifies the royal decision. "Even I know it's not that simple," Merthyn thought. "There's usually some kind of power struggle." But he said nothing. Gregory continued, "However, the ritual of the monks' election still goes on, and it is easier to control it than to abolish it. Hence my journey."
"So you're going to tell the monks whom to elect?" Merthyn said.
"To put it bluntly, yes."
"And what name will you give them?"
"Didn't I say? It's your bishop, Henri of Mons. Excellent man, loyal, trustworthy, never makes trouble."
"Oh dear.
You're not pleased?"
Gregory's relaxed air evaporated, and he became keenly attentive.
Merthyn realized that this was what Gregory had come for, to find out how the people of Kingsbridge, as represented by Merthyn, would feel about what he was planning, and whether they would oppose him. He collected his thoughts. The prospect of a new bishop threatened the spire and the hospital. "Henri is the key to the balance of power in this town," he said. 10 years ago, a kind of armistice was agreed between the merchants, the monks, and the hospital. As a result, all three have prospered mightily." Appealing to Gregory's interest and the king's, he added, "That prosperity is, of course, what enables us to pay such high taxes." Gregory acknowledged this with a dip of his head. "The departure of Henri obviously puts into question the stability of our relationships."
"It depends on who replaces him, I should have thought."
"Indeed," said Merthyn. "Now we come to the crux," he thought. He said, "Have you got anyone in mind?"
"The obvious candidate is Prior Philemon."
"No." Merthyn was aghast. "Philemon? Why?"
"He's a sound conservative, which is important to the church hierarchy in these times of skepticism and heresy."
"Of course. Now I understand why he preached a sermon against dissection, and why he wants to build a lady chapel."
"I should have foreseen this," Merthyn thought.
"And he has let it be known that he has no problem with taxation of the clergy, a constant source of friction between the king and some of his bishops. Philemon has been planning this for some time." Merthyn was angry with himself for letting this sneak up on him.
"Since the archbishop fell ill, I imagine."
"This is a catastrophe."
"Why do you say that?"
Philemon is quarrelsome and vengeful. If he becomes bishop, he will create constant strife in Kingsbridge. We have to prevent this. He looked Gregory in the eye. Why did you come here to forewarn me? As soon as he had asked the question, the answer came to him. You don't want Philemon either. You didn't need me to tell you what a troublemaker he is. You knew already. But you can't just veto him, because he has already won support among senior clergy. Gregory just smiled enigmatically, which Merthyn took to mean he was right. So what do you want me to do?
If I were you, Gregory said, I'd start by finding another candidate to put up as the alternative to Philemon.
So that was it. Merthyn nodded pensively. I'll have to think about this, he said.
Please do.
Gregory stood up, and Merthyn realized the meeting was over. And let me know what you decide, Gregory added. Merthyn left the priory and walked back to Leper Island, musing. Who could he propose as Bishop of Kingsbridge? The townspeople had always got on well with Archdeacon Lloyd, but he was too old. They might succeed in getting him elected, only to have to do the whole thing again in a year's time. He had not thought of anyone by the time he got home. He found Caris in the parlour and was about to ask her when she preempted him. Standing up, with a pale face and a frightened expression, she said, Lola's gone again. Chapter 86 The priests said Sunday was a day of rest, but it had never been so for Gwenda. Today, after church in the morning and then dinner, she was working with Wulfric in the garden behind their house. It was a good garden, half an acre with a henhouse, a pear tree and a barn. In the vegetable patch at the far end, Wulfric was digging furrows and Gwenda sowing peas. The boys had gone to another village for a football game, their usual recreation on Sundays. Football was the peasant equivalent of the nobility's tournaments, a mock battle in which the injuries were sometimes real. Gwenda just prayed her sons would come home intact. Today Sam returned early. The ball burst, he said grumpily.
Where's Davy? Gwenda asked.
He wasn't there.
I thought he was with you.
No, he quite often goes off on his own.
I didn't know that.
Gwenda frowned.
Where does he go?
Sam shrugged. He doesn't tell me. Perhaps he was seeing a girl, Gwenda thought. Davy was close about all sorts of things. If it was a girl, who was she? There were not many eligible girls in Wigley. The survivors of the plague had remarried quickly, as if eager to repopulate the land, and those born since were too young. Perhaps he was meeting someone from the next village, at a rendezvous in the forest. Such assignations were as common as heartache. When Davy came home a couple of hours later, Gwenda confronted him. He made no attempt to deny that he had been sneaking off.
I'll show you what I've been doing, if you like, he said. I can't keep it secret forever. Come with me.
They all went, Gwenda, Wulfric, and Sam. The Sabbath was observed to the extent that no one worked in the fields, and the 100-acre was deserted as the four of them walked across it in a blustery spring breeze. A few strips looked neglected. There were still villagers who had more land than they could cope with. Annette was one such. She had only her 18-year-old daughter, Amabel, to help her, unless she could hire labor, which was still difficult. Her strip of oats was getting weedy. Davy led them half a mile into the forest and stopped at a clearing off the beaten track.
This is it, he said.
For a moment, Gwenda did not know what he was talking about. She was standing on the edge of a nondescript patch of ground with low bushes growing between the trees. Then she looked again at the bushes. They were a species she had never seen before. It had a squarish stem with pointed leaves growing in clusters of four. The way it had covered the ground made her think it was a creeping plant. A pile of uprooted vegetation at one side showed that Davy had been weeding.
What is it? She said.
It's called madder.
I bought the seeds from a sailor that time we went to Malcolm.
Malcolm? Gwenda said. That was 3 years ago.
That's how long it's taken. Davy smiled. At first I was afraid it wouldn't grow at all. He told me it needed sandy soil and would tolerate light shade. I dug over the clearing and planted the seeds. But the first year I got only 3 or 4 feeble plants. I thought I'd wasted my money. Then, the second year, the roots spread underground and sent up shoots. And this year it's all over the place.
Gwenda was astonished that her child could have kept this from her for so long.
But what use is madder? She said. Does it taste good?
Davy laughed. No, it's not edible. You dig up the roots, dry them, and grind them to a powder that makes a red dye. It's very costly. Madge Weaver in Kingsbridge pays 7 shillings for a gallon.
That was an astonishing price, Gwenda reflected. Wheat, the most expensive grain, sold for about 7 shillings a quarter, and a quarter was 64 gallons.
This is 64 times as precious as wheat, she said.
Davy smiled. That's why I planted it.
Why you planted what? Said a new voice.
They all turned to see Nathan Reeve, standing beside a hawthorn tree as bent and twisted as he was. He wore a triumphant grin. He had caught them red-handed.
Davy was quick with an answer. This is a medicinal herb called hagwort, he said. Gwenda could tell he was improvising, but Nate would not be sure. It's good for my mother's wheezy chest.
Nate looked at Gwenda. I didn't know she had a wheezy chest.
In the winter, Gwenda said.
A herb, Nate said skeptically. There's enough here to dose all Kingsbridge. And you've been weeding it to get more.
I like to do things properly, Davy said. It was a feeble response, and Nate ignored it.
This is an unauthorized crop, he said.
First of all, serfs need permission for what they plant. They can't go raising anything they like. That would lead to total chaos. Secondly, they can't cultivate the Lord's forest, even by planting herbs.
None of them had any answer to that. Those were the rules. It was frustrating. Often peasants knew they could make money by growing non-standard crops that were in demand and fetched high prices. Hemp for rope, flax for expensive underclothing, or cherries to delight rich ladies. But many lords and their bailiffs refused permission out of instinctive conservatism.
Nate's expression was venomous.
One son a runaway and a murderer, he said. The other defies his lord. What a family!
He was entitled to feel angry, Gwenda thought. Sam had killed Jono and got away with it. Nate would undoubtedly hate her family to his dying day. Nate bent down and roughly pulled a plant out of the ground.
This will come before the manor court, he said with satisfaction,
and he turned and limped away through the trees. Gwenda and her family followed. Davy was undaunted.
Nate will impose a fine and I'll pay it, he said. I'll still make money.
What if he orders the crop destroyed? Gwenda said.
How?
It could be burnt or trampled.
Wulfric put in, Nate wouldn't do that. The village wouldn't stand for it. A fine is the traditional way to deal with this.
Gwenda said, I just worry about what Earl Ralph will say.
Davy made a deprecatory gesture with his hand.
No reason why the Earl should find out about a little thing like this.
Ralph takes a special interest in our family.
Yes, he does, Davy said thoughtfully. I still don't understand what made him pardon Sam.
The boy was not stupid.
Gwenda said, perhaps Lady Philippa persuaded him.
Sam said, she remembers you, mother. She told me that when I was at Merthin's house.
I must have done something to endear myself to her, Gwenda said, improvising. Or it could be that she just felt compassion, one mother for another.
It was not much of a story, but Gwenda did not have a better one.
In the days since Sam had been released, they had had several conversations about what might account for Ralph's pardon. Gwenda just pretended to be as perplexed as everyone else.
Fortunately, Wulfric had never been the suspicious type. They reached their house. Wulfric looked at the sky, said there was another good hour of light left, and went into the garden to finish sowing peas. Sam volunteered to help him. Gwenda sat down to mend a rip in Wulfric's hose. Davy sat opposite Gwenda and said, "I've got another secret to tell you." She smiled. She did not mind him having a secret, if he told his mother. "Go on." "I have fallen in love."
"That's wonderful!"
She leaned forward and kissed his cheek. "I'm very happy for you."
"What's she like?"
"She's beautiful." Gwenda had been speculating, before she found out about the matter, that Davy might be meeting a girl from another village. Her intuition had been right. "I had a feeling about this," she said.
"Did you?"
He seemed anxious.
"Don't worry, there's nothing wrong.
It just occurred to me that you might be meeting someone. We go to the clearing where I'm growing the madder. That's sort of where it started."
"And how long has this been going on?"
"More than a year."
"It's serious, then."
"I want to marry her."
"I'm so pleased."
She looked fondly at him. "You're still only 20, but that's old enough, if you found the right person. I'm glad you think so."
"What village is she from?"
"This one, Wagley."
"Oh?"
Gwenda was surprised. She had not been able to think of a likely girl here.
"Who is she?"
"Mother, it's Amabel."
"No! Don't shout! Not Annette's daughter!
You're not to be angry.
Not to be angry!"
Gwenda struggled to calm herself. She was as shocked as if she had been slapped. She took several deep breaths.
"Listen to me," she said. "We have been at odds with that family for more than 20 years. That cow, Annette, broke your father's heart and never left him alone afterwards."
"I'm sorry, but that's all in the past."
"It's not. Annette still flirts with your father every chance she gets."
"That's your problem,
not ours."
Gwenda stood up, her sewing falling from her lap.
"How can you do this to me? That bitch would be part of our family. My grandchildren would be her grandchildren. She'd be in and out of this house all the time, making a fool of your father with her coquettish ways and then laughing at me."
"I'm not going to marry Annette.
Amabel will be just as bad. Look at her. She's just like her mother."
"She's not, actually.
You can't do this. I absolutely forbid it."
"You can't forbid it, mother."
"Oh, yes, I can. You're too young. That won't last forever."
Wulfric's voice came from the doorway.
"What's all the shouting?"
"Davy says he wants to marry Annette's daughter, but I won't permit it."
Gwenda's voice rose to a shriek.
"Never, never, never!"
Earl Ralph surprised Nathan Reeve when he said he wanted to look at Davy's strange crop. Nate mentioned the matter in passing on a routine visit to Earl's castle. A bit of unlicensed cultivation in the forest was a trivial breach of the rules, regularly dealt with by a fine. Nate was a shallow man, interested in bribes and commissions, and he had little conception of the depth of Ralph's obsession with Gwenda's family, his hatred of Wulfric, his lust for Gwenda, and now the likelihood that he was Sam's real father. So Nate was startled when Ralph said he would inspect the crop next time he was in the neighbourhood. Ralph rode with Alan Fernhill from Earl's Castle to Wigley on a fine day between Easter and Whitsun. When they reached the small timber manor house, there was the old housekeeper, Vyra, bent and grey now, but still hanging on. They ordered her to prepare their dinner, then found Nate and followed him into the forest. Ralph recognized the plant. He was no farmer, but he knew the difference between one bush and another, and on his travels with the army he had observed many crops that did not grow naturally in England. He leaned down from his saddle and pulled up a handful.
"This is called madder," he said. "I've seen it in Flanders. It's grown for the red dye that has the same name."
Nate said, "He told me it was a herb called hagwort, used to cure a wheezy chest."
I believe it does have medicinal properties, but that's not why people cultivate it. What will his fine be?
A shilling would be the usual amount.
It's not enough.
Nate looked nervous. So much trouble is caused, Lord, when these customs are flouted. I would rather not.
Never mind, Ralph said. He kicked his horse and trotted through the middle of the clearing, trampling the bushes.
Come on, Alan, he said.
Alan imitated him, and the two of them cantered around in tight circles, flattening the growth. After a few minutes, all the shrubs were destroyed. Ralph could see that Nate was shocked by the waste, even though the planting was illegal. Peasants never liked to see crops despoiled. Ralph had learned in France that the best way of demoralizing the population was to burn the harvest in the fields.
That will do, he said, quickly getting bored.
He was irritated by Davy's insolence in planting this crop, but that was not the main reason he had come to Wigley. The truth was that he wanted to see Sam again. As they rode back to the village, he scanned the fields, looking for a tall young man with thick dark hair. Sam would stand out because of his height, among these stunted serfs hunched over their spades. He saw him at a distance in Brook Field. He reined in and peered across the windy landscape at the 22-year-old son he had never known. Sam and the man he thought was his father, Wulfric, were ploughing with a horse-drawn light plough. Something was wrong, for they kept stopping and adjusting the harness. When they were together, it was easy to see the differences between them. Wulfric's hair was tawny, Sam's dark. Wulfric was barrel-chested, ox-like, where Sam was broad-shouldered but lean, like a horse. Wulfric's movements were slow and careful, but Sam was quick and graceful. It was the oddest feeling to look at a stranger and think, "My son." Ralph believed himself immune to womanish emotions. If he had been subject to feelings of compassion or regret, he could not have lived as he had. But the discovery of Sam threatened to unman him. He tore himself away and cantered back to the village. Then he succumbed again to curiosity and sentiment, and sent Nate to find Sam and bring him to the manor house. He was not sure what he intended to do with the boy. Talk to him, tease him, invite him to join them for dinner, or what? He might have foreseen that Gwenda would not leave him free to choose. She showed up with Nate and Sam, and Wulfric and Davy followed them in. "What do you want with my son?" she demanded, speaking to Ralph as if he were an equal rather than her overlord. Ralph was sitting in the big oak chair with the lions carved on the arms. He spoke without forethought. "Sam was not born to be a serf tilling the fields," he said. He saw Alan Fernhill look at him in surprise. Gwenda looked puzzled. "Only God knows what we are born for," she said, playing for time. "When I want to know about God, I'll ask a priest, not you," Ralph said to her. "Your son has something of the mettle of a fighting man. I don't need to pray to see that. It's obvious to me, as it would be to any veteran of the wars." "Well, he's not a fighting man. He's a peasant, and the son of a peasant, and his destiny is to grow crops and raise livestock, like his father." "Never mind his father." Ralph remembered what Gwenda had said to him in the sheriff's castle at Shiring, when she had persuaded him to pardon Sam. "Sam has the killer instinct," he said. "It's dangerous in a peasant, but priceless in a soldier." Gwenda looked scared as she began to divine Ralph's purpose. "What are you getting at?" Ralph realized where this chain of logic was leading him. "Let Sam be useful, rather than dangerous. Let him learn the arts of war." "Ridiculous. He's too old. He's 22. It's late, but he's fit and strong. He can do it. I don't see how." Gwenda was pretending to find practical objections, but he could see through her simulation and knew that she hated the idea with all her heart. That made him all the more determined. With a smile of triumph, he said, "Easily enough, he can be a squire. He can come and live at Earl's Castle." Gwenda looked as if she had been stabbed. Her eyes closed for a moment, and her olive-skinned face paled.
She mouthed the word, no, but no sound came out.
"He's been with you for 22 years, Ralph said. "That's long enough."
Now it's my turn, he thought. But instead he said,
"Now he's a man."
Because Gwenda was temporarily silent, Wulfric spoke up. "We won't permit it," he said. "We are his parents, and we do not consent to this."
"I didn't ask for your consent," Ralph said contemptuously.
"I'm your earl, and you are my serfs. I don't request. I command." Nate Reeve put in, "Besides, Sam is over the age of 21, so the decision is his, not his father's." Suddenly they all turned and looked at Sam. Ralph was not sure what to expect. Becoming a squire was something many young men of all classes dreamed about, but he did not know whether Sam was one of them. Life in the castle was luxurious and exciting by comparison with breaking your back in the fields, but, on the other hand, men-at-arms died young, or, worse than that, came home crippled to live the rest of their miserable days begging outside taverns. However, as soon as Ralph saw Sam's face, he knew the truth. Sam was smiling broadly, and his eyes gleamed with eagerness. He could hardly wait to go. Gwenda found her voice.
"Don't do it, Sam," she said. "Don't be tempted. Don't let your mother see you blinded by an arrow, or mutilated by the swords of French knights, or crippled by the hooves of their war horses."
Wulfric said, "Don't go, son. Stay in Wagley and live a long life." Sam began to look doubtful. Ralph said, "All right, lad. You've listened to your mother and to the peasant father who raised you, but the decision is yours. What will you do? Live out your life here in Wagley, tilling the fields alongside your brother, or escape?" Sam paused only for a moment. He looked guiltily at Wulfric and Gwenda, then turned to Ralph.
"I'll do it," he said. "I'll be a squire, and thank you, my lord."
"Good lad," Ralph said.
Gwenda began to cry. Wulfric put his arm around her. Looking up at Ralph, he said, "When shall he go?"
"Today,"
Ralph said. "He can ride back to Earl's Castle with me and Alan after dinner."
"Not so soon,"
Gwenda cried. No one took any notice of her. Ralph said to Sam, "Go home and fetch anything you want to bring with you. Have dinner with your mother. Come back and wait for me in the stables. Meanwhile, Nate can requisition a mount to carry you to Earl's Castle." He turned away, having finished with Sam and his family.
"Now, where's my dinner?"
Wulfric and Gwenda went out with Sam, but Davy stayed behind. Had he already found out that his crop had been trampled, or was it something else? "What do you want?" Ralph said.
"Lord, I have a boon to ask."
This was almost too good to be true. The insolent peasant who had planted madder in the woods without permission was now a supplicant. What a satisfying day this was turning out to be.
"You can't be a squire. You've got your mother's build," Ralph told him, and Alan laughed.
"I want to marry Amabel, the daughter of Annet," said the young man.
"That won't please your mother.
I will be of age in less than a year."
Ralph knew all about Annet, of course. He had nearly been hanged for her sake. His history was entwined with hers almost as much as with Gwenda's. He recalled that all her family had died in the plague. "Annet still has some of the lands her father held."
"Yes, Lord, and she is willing for them to be transferred to me when I marry her daughter."
Such a request would not normally have been refused, although all lords would charge a tax called an entry fee on the transfer. However, there was no obligation on a lord to consent. The right of lords to refuse such requests on a whim and blight the course of a serf's life was one of the peasant's greatest gripes, but it provided the ruler with a means of discipline that could be extraordinarily effective.
"No," said Ralph, "I will not transfer the land to you."
He grinned. "You and your bride can eat madder." Chapter 87.
Carus had to prevent Philemon becoming bishop. This was his boldest move yet, but he had made his preparations carefully, and he had a chance. If he succeeded, he would have control of the hospital again, giving him the power to destroy her life's work. But he could do worse than that. He would revive the blind orthodoxy of the past. He would appoint hard-hearted priests like himself in the villages, close schools for girls, and preach sermons against dancing. She had no say in the choice of a bishop, but there were ways to exert pressure. She began with Bishop Henri. She and Merthyn travelled to Shiring to see the bishop in his palace. On the way, Merthyn stared at every dark-haired girl that came into view, and when there was no one, he scanned the woods at the side of the road. He was looking for Lola, but they reached Shiring without seeing any sign of her. The bishop's palace was on the main square, opposite the church and beside the wool exchange. It was not a market day, so the square was clear but for the scaffold that stood there permanently, a stark warning to villains of what the people of the county did to those who broke the law. The palace was an unpretentious stone building with a hall and chapel on the ground floor, and a series of offices and private apartments upstairs. Bishop Henri had imposed upon the place a style that Carus thought was probably French. Each room looked like a painting. The place was not decorated extravagantly, like Philemon's palace in Kingsbridge, where the profusion of rugs and jewels suggested a robber's cave. However, there was something pleasantly artful about everything in Henri's house, a silver candlestick placed to catch the light from a window, the polished gleam of an ancient oak table, spring flowers in the cold fireplace, a small tapestry of David and Jonathan on the wall. Bishop Henri was not an enemy, but he was not quite an ally either, Carus thought nervously, as they waited for him in the hall. He would probably say that he tried to rise above Kingsbridge quarrels. She, more cynically, thought that whatever decision he had to make, he remained unshakably focused on his own interests. He disliked Philemon, but he might not allow that to affect his judgment. Henri came in followed, as always, by Canon Claude. The two of them did not seem to age. Henri was a little older than Carus, and Claude perhaps 10 years younger, but they both looked like boys. Carus had noticed that clergy often aged well, better than aristocrats. She suspected it was because most priests, with some notorious exceptions, led lives of moderation. Their regime of fasting obliged them to eat fish and vegetables on Fridays and saints' days and all through Lent, and in theory they were never allowed to get drunk. By contrast, noblemen and their wives indulged in orgies of meat-eating and heroic wine-drinking. That might be why their faces became lined, their skin flaky, and their bodies bent, while clerics stayed fit and spry later into their quiet, austere lives. Merthyn congratulated Henri on having been nominated Archbishop of Monmouth, then got straight to the point. Prior Philemon has stopped work on the tower. Henri said with studied neutrality, "Any reason?" "There's a pretext and a reason," Merthyn said. "The pretext is a fault in the design." "And what is the alleged fault?" "He says an octagonal spire can't be built without formwork." "It is generally true, but I've found a way around it." "Which is?" "Rather simple. I will build a round spire, which will need no formwork, then give its exterior a cladding of thin stones and mortar in the shape of an octagon. Visually, it will be an octagonal spire, but structurally it will be a cone." "Have you told Philemon this?" "No. If I do, he'll find another pretext." "What is his real reason?" "He wants to build a lady chapel instead." "Ah." "It's part of a campaign to ingratiate himself with senior clergy. He preached a sermon against dissection when Archdeacon Reginald was there, and he has told the king's advisers that he will not campaign against taxation of the clergy." "What is he up to?" "He wants to be Bishop of Shiring." Henri raised his eyebrows. "Philemon always had nerve. I'll give him that."
Claude spoke for the first time. How do you know? Gregory Longfellow told me. Claude looked at Henri and said, Gregory would know if anyone does. Caris could tell that Henri and Claude had not anticipated that Philemon would be so ambitious. To make sure they did not overlook the significance of the revelation, she said, If Philemon gets his wish, you as Archbishop of Monmouth will have endless work adjudicating disputes between Bishop Philemon and the townspeople of Kingsbridge. You know how much friction there has been in the past. Claude said, We certainly do. I'm glad we're in agreement, Merthin said. Thinking aloud, Claude said, We must put forward an alternative candidate. That was what Caris had hoped he would say. We have someone in mind, she said. Claude said, Who? You. There was a silence. Caris could tell that Claude liked the idea. She guessed he might be quietly envious of Henri's promotion, and wondering whether it was his destiny always to be a kind of assistant to Henri. He could easily cope with the post of bishop. He knew the diocese well and handled most of the practical administration already. However, both men were now surely thinking about their personal lives. She had no doubt they were all but husband and wife. She had seen them kissing. But they were decades past the first flush of romance, and her intuition told her they could tolerate a part-time separation. She said, You would still be working together a good deal. Claude said, The Archbishop will have many reasons to visit Kingsbridge and Shiring. Henri said, And the Bishop of Kingsbridge will need to come to Monmouth often. Claude said, It would be a great honor to be bishop. With a twinkle in his eye, he added, Especially under you, Archbishop. Henri looked away, pretending not to notice the double meaning. I think it's a splendid idea, he said. Merthin said, The Kingsbridge Guild will back Claude, I can guarantee that. But you, Archbishop Henri, will have to put the suggestion to the king. Of course. Caris said, If I may make one suggestion? Please, find another post for Philemon. Propose him as, I don't know, Archdeacon of Lincoln, something he would like, but that would take him many miles from here. That's a sound idea, Henri said. If he's up for two posts, it weakens his case for either one. I'll keep my ear to the ground. Claude stood up. This is all very exciting, he said. Will you have dinner with us? A servant came in and addressed Caris. There's someone asking for you, mistress, the man said. It's only a boy, but he seems distressed. Henri said, Let him come in. A boy of about 13 appeared. He was dirty, but his clothes were not cheap, and Caris guessed he came from a family that was comfortably off, but suffering some kind of crisis. Will you come to my house, Mother Caris? I'm not a nun any more, child, but what's the problem? The boy spoke fast. My father and mother are ill, and so is my brother, and my mother heard someone say you were at the bishop's palace and said to fetch you, and she knows you help the poor, but she can pay, but will you please come, please? This type of request was not unusual, and Caris carried a leather case of medical supplies with her wherever she went. Of course I'll come, lad, she said. What's your name? Giles Spicer's, mother, and I'm to wait and bring you. All right. Caris turned to the bishop. Go ahead with your dinner, please. I'll join you as soon as I can. She picked up her case and followed the boy out. Shiring owed its existence to the sheriff's castle on the hill, just as Kingsbridge did to the priory. Near the market square were the grand houses of the leading citizens, the wool merchants and sheriff's deputies and royal officials, such as the coroner. A little farther out were the homes of moderately prosperous traders and craftsmen, goldsmiths and tailors and apothecaries. Giles's father was a dealer in spices, as his name indicated, and Giles led Caris to a street in this neighbourhood. Like most houses of this class,
It had a stone-built ground floor that served as a warehouse and shop, and flimsier timber living quarters above. Today the shop was closed and locked. Giles led Caris up the outside staircase. She smelled the familiar odor of sickness as soon as she walked in. Then she hesitated. There was something special about the smell, something that struck a chord in her memory that for some reason made her feel very frightened.